Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Viglund. The Fed cut a major interest rate this week, but it's not a cure-all for consumers. Ask this guy.
This will not have much of an effect.
That's economist Peter Morici with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Peter says some folks won't gain anything from the rate cut.
This will not have much of an effect.
So which unlucky group is Peter talking about? Is it A, homeowners with standard 30-year mortgages? This is not their chance to refi. Or is it B, folks with credit cards? It won't be any easier to get a better rate on that plastic. Or are the losers C, small businesses? It's been hard for them to get loans, and the rate cut won't change anything. Okay, only one of those choices is true, and you'll find out which one on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
Bernanke loves me. Bernanke loves me not. A lot of Wall Streeters were picking daisies this week. Were you? I'm Tess Viglund. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
As you may know by now, the Fed and its chairman, Ben Bernanke, showed the market some love this week by cutting the key federal funds rate by half a percentage point. The group cited fears of more economic chaos if it didn't. So we went to Wall Street, literally, and asked some folks there how they thought the rate cut would affect them.
It does affect me because I'm a homeowner, so it's going to ease up some of the stress that I'm feeling at the moment. And also, it's going to affect credit card interest rates as well.
No, I don't think it affects me because I'm not in a position to buy a house. I'm not borrowing $100,000 towards a home.
Well, I think the interest rates may keep falling. When people start losing their homes, they're going to be depressed. They're not going to spend money, and their dream has just exploded. That's not good.
Well, are they right? For some answers, we're turning to Peter Morici, who teaches economics at the University of Maryland. And Peter, what will this rate cut really do for the average consumer?
Well, it will affect the cost of borrowing for some but not all consumers. For example, if you have an adjustable rate mortgage, those are usually pegged to the one-year Treasury security or the one-year federal bond, and that rate will fall. So if you're facing an adjustment in your rate, it won't be as large now. Credit card debt, not much of an effect. Credit card companies will be able to borrow at a lower rate, but usually credit card companies don't change the rate they charge us unless we ask for a change. Once they got your business, they leave you alone. I would suggest that people with a good credit and a good payment record who have a large balance and have been paying consistently might want to call up and ask for a lower rate. They might get it.
Interesting. And what about home equity lines of credit?
Home equity lines of credit of a short duration could be somewhat cheaper. But if you're going to refinance a 30-year mortgage, this will not have much of an effect. Conventional mortgages generally track the 10-year U.S. bond, and that rate won't change much in response to this half a percentage point cut in short-term rates. Remember, what the Fed cut was the overnight rate to banks, the rate at which banks borrow from each other to maintain adequate reserves in their vaults against deposits.
Is there any downside to this rate cut? You know, there were some skeptics who said, you know what, they shouldn't be doing anything. They should just let things ride, and that a rate cut, in essence, would serve to help out the folks who made bad decisions in the first place, you know, who perhaps gave out credit that they shouldn't.
Well, some of the folks that made poor economic decisions by making loans they shouldn't make will be rewarded by this half a percentage point cut. However, a lot of ordinary people were suffering because of conditions in credit markets, and this will help make things better. For example, there are a lot of small businesses that rely on bank lines of credit. They weren't involved in the subprime crisis. They were having trouble getting loans. This may free that situation up a bit.
And what about the housing market? Will this make it easier for people to jump back into that market?
It will not make it easier to get a 30-year conventional mortgage. That will take changes at Fannie Mae. However, it does make people more confident about the future. You see the stock market prices rising. You see businesses generally more optimistic. That causes people to feel more secure about their jobs, which they should. If you could afford a home in June, you can still afford a home today. In fact, it may be a little easier because prices have eased. This is a very good time to buy a home.
Well, one of the words that has been rearing its head over the last several weeks, at the very least, is the notion of a recession and whether that was on the horizon. What does this week's Fed action mean there?
Well, it's not a matter of postponing a recession. It's a matter of whether we have one or not. Recessions are not inevitable. Recessions happen today because we make mistakes. The real question is, was the subprime crisis enough to cause a recession? The consensus of economists is there's about a one-third to one-half chance of a recession between now and the first quarter of next year. This reduces the prospects of a recession. Historically, an interest rate cut like this doesn't have a major effect on the economy until we're about 6 months out, because it takes that long to feed through the process of buying homes, building homes, buying appliances, making appliances, and so forth. But so much of the problems that we have right now are psychological, that a step up to the plate by the Fed to saying we're prepared to shore up the economy, we're prepared to avert a recession rather than just punish borrowers, has an extraordinarily positive effect. I think that this rate cut, if coupled with perhaps another cut in 6 weeks, would be enough to avert a recession.
Well, look into your crystal ball. I mean, in 6 weeks, are we going to get another rate cut?
With Bernanke, all you can say is it depends on the kinds of numbers we get over the next 6 weeks. If the numbers are good over the next 6 weeks, we will not get another rate cut. However, if there are more signs that the economy is slowing or heading for a recession, we will get another one. For example, in the last 2 weeks, we had a terrible jobs report and a very poor retail sales report. Let's see what we get next month in terms of jobs creation, retail sales, consumption spending, and so forth. Business spending on medium-sized items like computers and software will be very critical to his thinking.
Peter Morici is an economist and a professor at the University of Maryland School of Business. Thanks for helping us parse this out.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It's always a pleasure.
And Peter mentioned that this rate cut won't make it easier to get a conventional 30-year mortgage, that will depend on changes at Fannie Mae. Well, they may be coming, and we'll have more on that later in the show.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
Here's one side effect of the Fed's interest rate cut. The U.S. dollar hit new lows against the euro this week. And for the first time in 30 years, the Canadian dollar is equal to the greenback. That means vacations north of the border aren't the bargains they once were, and trips across the pond could get even crazier expensive than they already were. We asked Elisa Roth if she might be able to find some folks who are feeling the currency pinch right now.
My parents, the lucky dogs, happened to be at a conference in Amsterdam this week. So I called my dad and asked him, what's up?
What's up? The euro sure is up.
He's not kidding. Everything they buy there, from hotel rooms to coffee and presents for their kids, is crazy expensive. My dad says he knew it would be bad even before they took off.
Got on the plane from New York to Amsterdam, and the Dutch people returning home from a weekend or a week in New York just had suitcases that were overflowing.
They're staying in the cheapest hotel they could find, and it's still costing more than $300 a night. The hotel's part of my dad's idea for dealing with how expensive everything is.
The breakfast is included, and it's a generous breakfast. We sit down and have a long, slow breakfast, and you hardly eat any lunch.
But he has another strategy, too.
I just basically make believe that the prices are really in dollars. Because if I converted into euros, I wouldn't buy anything, and I wouldn't do anything. So I'm only here for a week, and it would just be a miserable time if I did otherwise.
As for my mom,
The $5 cup of coffee was a sort of a shock.
But the falling dollar has been good news to some people. They just don't happen to be in my family. Trevor Swanson manages a shoe store in Thief River Falls, Minnesota, about 75 miles from the Canadian border. He says he's been seeing a lot more Canadians in his store lately.
I don't really say a whole lot about the exchange, but you can tell just because of how many more people are coming in now compared to what it was.
Canadians are still only about 5% of his store's business, but he says every bit counts. In fact, he says, if the loonie keeps holding its own against the dollar, he'll start advertising on their side of the border. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Hi, I'm Trash Viglund. Or was it Mess Viglund? No, I know, it was Bag Lady. The name-calling began last weekend as I started 2 weeks of carrying my trash around with me wherever I go, 24/7. It's part of a special project that'll air in November called Consumed. We're asking whether our consumption habits are sustainable. I'll have an update in a minute, but first, a couple of clips of reactions to this trash challenge. First, my husband, as we took out the final pre-challenge trash bags.
So this is going to be the last garbage and recycling you take out for a couple of weeks. Is that good news for you?
We'll see.
We pretty much revert to gender roles when it comes to taking out the garbage. How much garbage do you think we generate? How many of these kitchen bags?
Oh, I don't know. I think I make about 3 trips a week.
3 trips a week?
Out to the bins, yeah.
What do you think we can get it down to?
About 3 trips a week. I hate to be a cynic, but it's going to take a lot of effort to, you know, get the garbage down to a bag you can carry around.
Well, hey, at least you don't have to carry it around.
Thank goodness for that. No, I think we'll be doing a lot of recycling and a lot of things down the disposal. And maybe the dog is going to get really healthy and have some great human food. Right, dog?
It's true, we've been giving a lot more leftovers to the dog. She loves us even more now. And more food is probably going down the disposal. But so far, he's wrong about the trash bags. The only trip to our bins this week was for recycling. And here's another sample of reaction to the experiment. My piano teacher, Elizabeth Baber, left this message on my voicemail after hearing an interview I did with Marketplace host Kai Rizdahl the day before the challenge.
Hi, Tess. This is Elizabeth. I'm in the car, and I just caught you on the radio, and I applaud your efforts to carry your garbage everywhere. However, do not bring it to your piano lesson. I'm sure it'll be nice and safe in the car. I will see you soon. Bye.
Yes, my new best friend, the garbage bag, has gotten many a cold shoulder this week. But it's also gotten lots of support from you. Dozens of you have written in with suggestions for how to do more composting and recycling, and some of you are taking the challenge. You can find photos of my growing garbage bag, along with my daily trash blog, on our website, marketplace.org. Care to join me? Sometimes it pays to ignore your parents' advice, like when they tell you, don't bother filing your taxes. Chris files his advice in the mailbag. And you think you've got a lot of responsibility at work?
If I underpredict, then people could be trapped, possibly by fire.
A day in the work life of a fire behavior analyst. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Here in Southern California, we ended the week with unseasonably chilly temperatures and even some rain. Hard to believe we started the week with heat and wildfires. Humidity helped contain a blaze that burned more than 14,000 acres of forest in San Bernardino. But firefighters can't just rely on help from the weather. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet a guy whose job is to predict how fires will burn. We found him sizing up a blaze in Idaho.
From up here on top of the ridge, I could get a better look down into the drainage where we're trying to hold the fire. The smoke's kind of cleared out of the drainage a fair amount. which means it's probably drying out pretty quick. Fire activity will probably be picking up in there pretty decent next 2 to 3 hours. I'm Mike Powell. I'm the fire behavior analyst on the California Team 3. Right now, the fire isn't behaving very well. To tell you a little bit, I think we're into a big fight here this afternoon. The trees, they want to burn. They'll send up embers and they'll cause spot fires out in front of it. The terrain is real steep. Fire generally likes to run uphill because heat rises, and so this thing's been running uphill quite a bit. I think this is day 6. And how am I feeling right now? Actually, reasonable. You know, it's definitely times where I'm mentally stressed out, because if I underpredict, then the fire can move into places we weren't expecting it to move. People could be trapped, possibly, by fire. You're never perfect, and personally, I'd like to be perfect. I get a lot of my information just from listening to the radio. I'm scanning a bunch of different channels, and so I'm listening to what other people are saying about what's happening.
It's definitely a lot more active right now as compared to the same time yesterday.
There are computer models, and you can look at those, but computers can't model nature completely is the biggest problem. If you start walking up the hills, you find out how steep they really are. If you're walking through the grass, you'll see how thick it is. You'll hear things crackle under your feet that tells you a different story. To become a fire behavior expert, there are some classes that you have to take, but it's really just a real small part of it. A lot of it's the experience that you've had. I've been a firefighter since 1980, and personally I still like to consider myself a firefighter if I can get away from this job and the computers for a little bit. Been on hot shot crews for 10 years, worked on engines for about 5, and I've gotten to see quite a bit of fire in quite a few different places, and in my mind that's really what is needed to be a fire behavior analyst. People out here actually don't make a whole lot of money. The general firefighter that's a federal employee makes probably about $12 an hour in normal rates. They do get a lot of overtime when they're out here. They'll be working 16-hour days. They'll be getting hazard pay on top of that. So, you know, it may get up to like $18-$20 an hour. Don't get extra money for being a fire behavior specialist. Generally, I'll make about $70,000 a year, but it's taken pushing 30 years to get to this point, too. You can get by on it. You know, hopefully they enjoy doing it, and I think that's why a lot of these people are really out here, is because you can feel good about doing the job that you're doing.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Elizabeth Wynn Johnson.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over 1 billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
The lender of last resort brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, discount rate. The discount rate is what the Fed charges commercial banks for loans. It's not to be confused with what commercial banks charge each other. That's the federal funds rate. This week, the Fed made noise when they cut the discount rate by a half point. It showed how bad the credit crunch had become. See, banks prefer borrowing from other banks because it's cheap. But when there's a money crisis and loans get scarce, sometimes there's no choice. Go to the central bank or try another option. Sell lemonade?
Got a box full of letters. Thinking my life to read.
Got financial questions? Well, you are in luck, because this is the time in the show when we answer all sorts of puzzling paycheck predicaments. How's that for alliteration, Mr. Chris Farrell?
That was pretty good. I like that. I like that a lot.
All right. Well, before we get to your questions, please head over to marketplace.org and click on the contact button. Or you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And our first caller is John. He's in Greencastle, Indiana. Hi, John.
Hello there.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am currently working as an off-campus study advisor for students traveling abroad at DePaul University.
Okay, and are you studying there?
No, I'm a graduate, but I am a prospective master's student candidate at Indiana University.
Oh, what would you be getting your master's in?
I'll be getting it in French linguistics.
French linguistics?
Yes.
What do you do with something like that?
Well, you become a teacher.
Okay.
We'll see what happens.
You learn French linguistics to teach it.
Exactly. To teach it, or I could possibly go down the nonprofit sector. Yeah, we'll see what happens.
Well, what's your question for Chris today?
My question concerns taxes, filing income taxes, and at what age should you file?
How old are you?
I'm 26.
Okay.
And growing up, my first job at the age of 17, at the end of the year, my family told me that it wasn't really necessary to file taxes. And I pretty much followed their advice. They said that, well, you didn't make enough money. What's the point of filing? You're not going to get anything back. And so I didn't file. And every year I would go back and say, okay, Mom, what should I do? I'll go ahead and file this year. She says, well, let me see your W-2 forms. Oh, that's not enough. Don't even waste your time filing. It's
oh,
okay.
My.
You'll be fine. So what are you, what's wrong?
Well, Chris, I'm just going to do a mind meld with you and say, perhaps we shouldn't have listened to Mom.
Not in this case. First of all, the odds are you're probably owed money. My guess is that along the way, you know, money was withheld. And you basically made very little or hardly anything. And so you're not really in trouble. You probably have left money on the wayside. And by the way, there is there's really no statute of limitations on when you owe the government money. There is actually a 3-year statute of limitations when the government owes you money.
So you have to file within 3 years in order to get the money that Uncle Sam owes you.
Exactly.
So really, if you file right now and you are owed a refund, you're only going to get it from when you were 23. If you're 26 now, you can't get the refunds that you were due when you were 17 and 18 and 19.
Here's my recommendation. It's very simple. And you know, this is one of those cases where it really does make sense to hire a tax professional. You don't need a highfalutin one. You just hire someone who's competent. And you go to them. They'll tell you, look, here's the forms you're going to need. That's where all the work's going to come in. You're going to lose a couple of weekends drinking as much coffee as is possible, seeking for various documents. You get some help. If it turns out that you're owed a little bit of money next year, then at least we'll get you some.
Okay, so the advice is to go ahead and deal with Uncle Sam once you start making some money.
You know, Tess, it's part of life. It may not be the most enjoyable part of life, but it's...
May not be.
Well, you know, trying to be a master of understatement here, you know?
All right, so does that help you out, John?
That helps out tremendously. Thank you all so much.
Well, we hope you have a really wonderful time filing your first tax return.
I hope it is a wonderful time and not a nightmare. We'll see.
Good luck.
Bye-bye.
All right, let's reach into the email bag, Chris. And Teresa writes in from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and she's an independent contractor. So she wants to know, what is the difference between a SEP IRA and a simple IRA plan?
All right, here's how I divide the world. A SEP IRA is a retirement plan that is just beautifully designed for the moonlighter, the freelancer, because it's no muss, no fuss, simple to set up, easy to maintain, everything like that. A simple IRA, which was established several years ago, and the idea was a lot of small businesses with 100 or fewer employees, they weren't setting up 401ks because they were too expensive. The administrative costs were too expensive. So, quote unquote, the simple IRA was created. If you're a business and you have 25, 30, 40 employees, you're going to look at the simple IRA as an option. So if she has a SEP IRA, it's great, it's wonderful, it's easy. If she has 30 to 40 employees, then she might want to look at the simple IRA.
All right. Well, you know, what's a simple response to a lot of complicated financial questions? Help! But if you are someone who's screaming for financial assistance, why don't you just give us a call? We'll try our best. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org, or call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right. Caller number two is with us. Bob is in Mountain View, California. Welcome to the program.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. You're sounding a little tired.
Well, no, I'm fine. Sounds can be deceiving.
But I understand that you work the graveyard shift.
Yes, it is the graveyard shift. So I normally don't wake up until around noon.
And who is it that forces you to work on the overnights?
Oh, it's the evil post office.
Oh, no. All right. Well, thank you for staying up all night to make sure we get our mail. But what kind of solution can we deliver for you?
Okay, well, you need to break the tie here. My girlfriend thinks that I'll be fine if I retire. I'm having second and third thoughts. I'm 70 years old. If I were to retire at the end of this year, I would retire with about 74% of my pre-retirement income.
Is that a pension?
Yes, from the post office. I own my own condominium, which is worth about $350,000. In addition, I have about $165,000 in an IRA, but of course, it's a regular IRA, by the way.
Okay.
But since I'm 70 years old, that means that next year I'm going to have to start drawing down that IRA. So my two obvious questions are, A, am I in a position to retire? And B, if I am, do you have any thoughts concerning that $165,000? Should I just leave it there and draw down the minimum every single year and pay taxes on it? Or do you have some other ideas for that amount of money?
Well, have you figured out what exactly you would have to live on should you retire?
As a matter of fact, I have. But, of course, I've only figured out what my known expenses are.
Okay.
I have no idea what my unknown expenses are.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of money that I have coming in probably exceeds my known expenses by about $500 to $600 a month.
Okay. And what's the benefit to you of not retiring? Does that affect what percentage you get in your pension?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Every year that you stick around, you get an additional 2%.
Ah, okay. All right. Well, what do you think, Chris? Should he retire?
On a financial basis, you know, with all the caveats I could toss in there, but on a financial basis, you can retire. The issue is, do you want to retire? Are you getting other things beyond finance by working at the post office that you're enjoying yourself, or this is what you want to be doing? And the notion of not working at the post office is something you don't want to contemplate. I don't know, but we'd be getting to questions like that as opposed to the dollars and cents.
So what's the answer to that, Bob? Do you want to keep working?
The answer is that no. No, I don't get a lot of pleasure out of working at the post office.
What would you like to be doing?
Oh, yeah, there's traveling, there's I love to read, I like to be physically active. I could fill my day.
Okay. There's a good book, if you like to read, and you can read it fairly quickly, it's by Lee Eisenberg. It's called The Number. And The Number is exactly what you're asking. Do I have enough to retire on? The other thing is then, you know, here's where we start getting the fascinating things about dreams. You know, you want to travel. Where do you want to travel to? You can go online. How much is that going to cost you? And then you can start looking at the money you've got that's going to be coming in for your pension, where you want to be traveling, and what your normal expenses are going to be. Do the numbers add up? My suspicion is the numbers are going to add up. That's a way that you can sort of take these financial numbers and take these goals like travel and turn them into a reality. And I take advantage of the time while you're still healthy and you're still engaged and you want to be doing these things. Because unfortunately, there's going to come a time when it's going to be harder and harder to do things like travel.
Right. Don't most financial analysts recommend retiring with at least 80% of your pre-retirement income?
Yeah, 75 to 80%. And the reason why they're doing that is there's a big drop in your expenses. But the problem with that number is I know people who have needed 110% of what their pre-retirement income was because of their dreams of what they wanted to do. I've known other people, you know, that their idea of a great time is hiking and walking and going to lectures, and they've only needed 65% of their pre-retirement income.
I see.
So does that help you out, Bob?
Oh, sure does.
Well, now you've got me thinking about retirement, and I'm at least 35 years away, so.
Oh, wow. Well, listen, you guys have a great program, and I really enjoy your advice.
Well, thanks so much for the call.
Oh, you bet.
Enjoy your retirement.
Bye.
Well, sometimes you spend so much time working, you never know when it's okay to stop. If you're thinking about retirement, maybe don't know if you should, give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, email number two is from Daniel in San Diego, California, and he opened a CD for $100,000 several months ago at Countrywide Bank. And we've had lots of questions about Countrywide recently, Chris. And the CD comes due in February of next year, 2008. Of course, the FDIC protects his investment up to $100,000. So he's wondering if the interest that he earns is at risk if something happens to Countrywide. So what would happen? Would he lose his entire investment? Would he lose just the interest? What exactly does the FDIC protection cover?
All right, so let's walk through. It's the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and they protect that CD up to $100,000. So let's say he made $2,000. So he has $102,000. He's protected up to the $100,000. The $2,000 is at risk, which is why when you're putting a certificate of deposit and you're thinking about $100,000, what you do is, depending on what the interest rate is, you do a quick calculation, you might put in $85,000 or $95,000 in order to stay under that $100,000 limit. But here's something I discovered recently, Tess. The FDIC has the Electronic Deposit Insurance Estimator. If you have any questions, and you can type in your data and see whether or not you're protected or not.
Oh, interesting. Okay, and we'll have a link to that on our website. Just look under the Web Surfer feature there. So if you had $100,000 that you wanted to invest, what you're saying is maybe you invest $95,000 instead, so the interest that you earn is covered under the $100,000, and then your other $5,000 investment can go into a different account.
That's right. Or what a lot of people do is they'll put $50,000 into one bank in one account, certificate of deposit,
right,
and $50,000 into another bank. Your $100,000 is now completely protected no matter what rate of interest that you're making. I'm assuming you're not going to be making a 50, 60, 70% rate of interest in making that statement. But
if you do, I'd like to know where you bank.
Exactly. And then I have a feeling FDIC is not going to be part of the initials. I think Pyramid is going to be the one under there. So you put it in two different financial institutions, two separate accounts, and they are both protected up to the $100,000.
Okay. But for Daniel, essentially the interest that he earns on the CD is potentially at risk if, and that's a big if, something were to happen to Countrywide, but his initial investment is safe.
And by the way, can I just put one myth to rest that I've been hearing lately?
Please.
If it's insured, the goal is of the FDIC, and they achieve it almost all the time, is you have access to your money next business day.
Okay. Well, there you go, folks. Unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. Do leave your questions for a future program on our voicemail. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or visit our contact page on our website, marketplace.org. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, it's fighting time. We tackle the emotional side of investing. But don't cry. We're talking neuroeconomics. Like, what you know may surprise you.
People believe that if they had more money, they would be happier. But they're wrong.
And find out how to take on the workplace bully and win. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. For some unfortunate souls out there, the formative years were plagued with fears of being trapped inside a gym locker or getting swirlies in the bathroom. Of course, I'm talking about being bullied.
I'm dead meat on a stick.
How much money you got?
$1.03, Mr. Bully, sir.
Keep a change.
Thanks, man.
Oh, Nelson. Well, luckily, most of us have put goons like him behind us. Or have we? As Andrea Gardner found out, there's a disturbing new trend in office harassment claims, workplace bullying.
It's why we watched shows like The Apprentice.
You did a bad job. I have to say, Mona, you're fired. Sorry. Thank you. Go. Thank you.
Americans have long loved shows with bullish bosses because they can relate. Some workers are lucky. They can stand up for themselves.
Male, kiss my grit!
Others aren't so lucky. They take so much abuse at work, they develop health problems.
Hello? Hi, Oscar, it's Michael. Heard you're under the weather. What are your symptoms?
In a number of cases, it's stomach problems, ulcers, and depression, and many are feeling the pain. Studies show 1 in 6 Americans will be bullied at work at some point in their lives. But the law doesn't define workplace bullying in clear terms. Here's labor law professor and workers' advocate David Yamada.
Right now, if a bullied employee is looking for a legal theory under which to sue, they're not going to find a lot of promising avenues. In many bullying cases, it's hard to identify the specific reason or reasons why somebody is being mistreated. And oftentimes, those reasons may be very personal and somewhat subjective.
Yamada is pushing for states to enact anti-bullying legislation based on a bill he wrote. It requires workers to prove they've been physically or psychologically harmed by a bully. It also includes definitions of workplace bullying. For example, derogatory remarks and insults are defined as abusive conduct. So is speaking to someone in a way that a reasonable person finds to be intimidating. So far, 13 states have introduced versions of this law, though none have yet passed. If laws are enacted, companies will likely scramble to implement new policies. They'll turn to workplace consultants, people like Gary Namy. He stresses clearly written rules and follow through. That means all office bullies are dealt with, from the cubicle to the corner office.
The key is faithful enforcement of bullies at all ranks within an organization. And that's where we get tripped up. There is a reluctance to hold people accountable at all levels.
Many employers form a committee of workers to evaluate the bullying claims from their peers and resolve the problems. Typical disciplinary measures are written warnings, management training, and in extreme situations, getting fired. But Namy says few cases go to the enforcement stage because most office bullies are actually sheep in wolf's clothing.
The people who bully are soccer moms and great community volunteers and all the rest, but at work they slip into a role that they think requires them to be hyper-aggressive. When the rules are switched, they'll quickly abandon it because it's not who they are.
The nonprofit organization Goodwill Los Angeles hired Namy after CEO Doug Barr noticed some workplace conflicts. Barr says he took a proactive approach, which many employers are hesitant to do.
Some administrators or managers might be loath to implement something like this because it seems like it's admitting that your organization is falling apart. And I don't think that's the way to approach it. I see it as a real asset in terms of recruitment and retention of staff.
Barr says his organization is now viewed as an employer of choice and has seen strong job applicants and happy longtime employees since instituting the anti-bullying policy. A lesson for the Lou Grants, Miranda Priestleys, and Michael Scotts of the world. I'm Andrea Gardner for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Why do so many of us fail to invest in a retirement plan as soon as we get out of college, even though we know we should? Why do we get all excited about a pay raise, then a few days or weeks later, the thrill is gone? Theories abound about why we act the way we do about money. An entire scientific field called neuroeconomics is dedicated to studying our brains on money. And Jason Zweig has written a book about it called, appropriately enough, Your Money and Your Brain. Jason, why are we destined to make all these bad money choices?
Our brains are designed in such a way that we don't really learn from our financial mistakes. We become all the more determined to repeat them. We just don't want to repeat the same mistake in the same way. Let's say back in 1999, you fell in love with internet stocks like everybody else, and you went out and bought some great company like Pets.com.
Who wouldn't do that because of a great sock puppet?
Right, exactly. And so you got wiped out. You lost 99% of your money. And what lesson did you learn? You didn't learn the lesson, well, I shouldn't chase hot stocks just because everyone else is chasing them. The lesson you learned is, I chased the wrong hot stock.
Well, speaking of socks, the most common phrase that you hear when people talk about deciding on their investments and where to put their money is, how much risk are you comfortable with? And at one point, you talk about our decision process when we're buying socks versus buying stocks. What is it in our brains that allows us to be so much more rational or wise when it comes to socks?
Well, yeah, you know, if Walmart or Kmart or wherever you do most of your shopping puts socks on sale, you don't run screaming away from the store saying, oh my God, they just got cheaper, I don't want any. But when stocks go on sale, when they drop in price, everyone panics and runs screaming down Wall Street trying to get out of the way. What happens is when stocks move, when the price goes up, the human brain is designed, after two up trades in a row, automatically to expect a third. When they become cheaper, when the price is going down, all the brain can do is predict more on the downside.
How hard is it to take all this information and use it to actually change your habits?
Well, on one level, it's very hard, Tess. On another level, it's pretty easy.
Let's go with the easy part.
Let's go with the easy part. The easy lesson is that you need to become more mindful. For example, one of the best things you can do as an investor is keep an emotional journal. Think back to July when the Dow hit 14,000. Almost everyone felt extremely happy and buoyant at how well the market was doing and how smart they were.
Yeah, you look at your 401k returns and think, hey, good for me.
I did something great, right?
Right.
If you kept an emotional journal and every day you ask the question, how do I feel about the market and how do I feel about the portfolio that I have? You would have written everything was great and you were really happy. Maybe looking back on that today, you could learn the obvious lesson because your emotions are almost always backwards. When stocks become more expensive, you really shouldn't become happier. You should become more concerned. And it's probably a time, if not to scale back the risks you're taking, at least not to add any more risk on top of it.
Jason, the subtitle of your book is How the New Science of Neuroeconomics Can Help Make You Rich. Has it made you rich?
Well, I would like to say yes. What I will say, because I can't really say yes, is that it has encouraged me that the investing plan I've had in place for many years is a very good one. I essentially make no investing decisions whatsoever. My entire portfolio is on autopilot. Money is automatically deducted from my bank account and electronically transferred to several index mutual funds that own every stock or bond. It's very diversified. The risk is about as low as you can go, and the cost is absolutely as low as you can get.
And what about outside of investing, the rest of your financial life? Do you feel that knowing about neuroeconomics has helped you make spending and saving decisions?
Yes, I think it has. There are a lot of practical lessons. One is when you are saving for a long-term goal, well off in the distance, you have to make it concrete. If it's just an abstract goal called retirement, you will not be motivated. But if you call it the Tuscan Villa Fund, you will be much more motivated to save than you would be if you just thought about it as retirement.
All right. Well, I think I'm going to have to go start my Tuscan Villa Fund as soon as we're done here.
I hope you have a guest bedroom, Tess.
Jason Zweig is the author of Your Money and Your Brain. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure, Tess. Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
like it's going to be the best
they
quarter.
Decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor Chris Farrell to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what is the straight story. And Chris, I've noticed the phrase "Social Security reform" starting to crop up again a bit.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Big administration priority back in 2004 and then just kind of drowned in a big old sea of politics. But it is the political season.
That's true. And, you know, that's why I was really intrigued by this op-ed piece. It was in the Wall Street Journal by Rahm Emanuel. Mm-hmm. You've heard of him. He's the chairman of the House Democratic Caucus.
Right.
And he wants to bring back an old idea, or at least one that's been circulating for a number of years. Rather than privatize Social Security, let's create personal investment accounts for every American so that in addition to their Social Security account, every worker, in essence, is going to get a 401k.
Hmm.
Here's the straight story. It's a great idea. supplementing Social Security is a good start toward boosting everyone's financial future.
All right, well, let's break this down really quickly. The Bush administration, they wanted to partially privatize Social Security. Remind us what that was all about.
All right, so you pay payroll taxes, goes into your Social Security account. Mm-hmm. They wanted to say, all right, you can take 1% or 2% and put it into a private account.
You would manage it instead of the government.
And you would manage it. And a big part of this is privatizing Social Security would actually make the funding shortfall worse because you are reducing the amount of payroll taxes that are going into the general trust fund. And a lot of people who support Social Security said, whoa, this is not the way to go.
Now, Rahm Emanuel is proposing something very different, but is this still a form of privatization?
Now, what he's saying is, let's leave Social Security alone. Mm-hmm. And I'm in the camp that says, leave it alone. Funding shortfall is not a big deal. And if you want to make some adjustments, fine, we can negotiate that over time. But what we do is we take that Social Security account and we put on top of it a private account. Because here's the real retirement disgrace in this country. It's that half of American workers, 75 million workers, do not have access to a retirement plan at work. And I know they could set up an IRA, but think about it, Tess. You haven't managed any money. You haven't invested. And now you have to decide, do you do an IRA, a Roth IRA, a non-deductible IRA? It's a very complicated world. Mm-hmm. So this is a way of addressing the real disgrace in America's retirement system.
Well, riddle me this. We've got this funding shortfall, whether it's big or small, up for debate. But given that, how likely is it that we're going to set aside more money for this other retirement fund?
Okay. Now, you're putting aside the money.
Ah, so it's access to a retirement plan.
Exactly.
Okay.
Built on top of your Social Security number. So when you're born, you get a Social Security number. You also get access to a private retirement plan. And the model that he suggests, and this is what I do really like about the plan, federal government runs the Thrift Savings Plan. It's very good. Has a lot of several broad-based options, but here's the part that I like, and you know how I like to talk about fees.
Mm-hmm.
So the annual fee in the Thrift Savings Plan is 30 cents for every $1,000 you've invested. Now, you compare that to the average mutual fund. The average fee is $15.50 for every $1,000 invested. Now, I'm not a math genius.
I go for the Thrift Savings Plan.
The Thrift Savings Plan, compounded over time, yeah. It's a much better deal.
But wouldn't this simply be the line the pockets of Wall Street yet again act?
That is always a risk. People like me and Rahm Emanuel and his proposal, what he suggested is you keep it to the broad-based options. We talk a lot about these life cycle funds, basically an equity index fund, a bond index fund, some cash. And then depending on how old you are and your risk tolerance, it's invested for you. So we keep it really simple. I do believe over time that you'd end up with a dot-com mutual fund option or a subprime mortgage real estate option that you might be able to invest in. But what I'm hoping is that the default options would be very conservative. Yes, there's going to be some lining of the pockets of Wall Street, but the fact of the matter is Social Security is just not enough for the low-income worker. So let's address the retirement problem, particularly of low-income workers, or at least workers who work at a place where there isn't a retirement plan.
All right, the straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks for lining our pockets with so much wonderful information.
I love that. Thanks a lot, Dan.
Fannie and Freddie were back in the news this week. That's Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They're the two government-sponsored entities, or GSEs, that buy up mortgages from banks and other lenders. There's been talk the last couple of months about raising the cap on the size of mortgage Fannie and Freddie can buy. The Bush administration had opposed that move, but this week the Treasury Secretary said, well, maybe we should. Joining us to help explain is Nick Ritsinas, who teaches housing economics at Harvard. And hey, Nick, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
I want to play for you a quick clip from Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson from this week. He was on the Hill talking about this possibility of raising the loan limits that Freddie and Fannie can hand out. So let's listen to that real quick.
There is no doubt that raising the loan limit somewhat to allow the GSEs to guarantee jumbo mortgages would be helpful to a segment of the market which has shown some recent improvement but is not yet functioning as normal.
All right, so let's start with the very basics. What is this loan limit at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac?
The loan limit says that mortgages below that limit, which now is $417,000, are eligible to be purchased and or guaranteed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
And what's the advantage of that?
The advantage of that, when Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac are either purchasing or guaranteeing loans, the money they raise to do that will be loaned to them at lower rates because the investors believe that those loans have the implicit guarantee of the federal government.
Now, if this number is raised, that then changes, I guess, how many people are able to get federally backed mortgages.
It does. It literally changes the number of the size and therefore number of mortgages that can be guaranteed by these entities. Now, will it make much of a difference in Omaha? Probably not. But if you're looking at the two coasts, where it is not unusual for median home prices to be over $500,000, it could add pretty substantially to the number of mortgages and thus number of homes that can be financed through these agencies.
All right. Well, I guess we'll wait to find out if this actually happens. Nick Ritsinas is the director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, selling your house with the help of a home stager.
She set out candles as big as fire hydrants. Overnight, I was living in a Pottery Barn showroom.
Ooh, sounds nice. Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.